Welcome to another episode of The Late Set. I'm Josh Jackson.
And I'm Nate Chenin.
And this episode is dropping on my favorite day, April Fool's Day. Because I'm a huge fool, first of all. And, Nate, this is my 25th anniversary. I got married on April 1st, 2000. I made sure that I knew always the day, because it's April Fool's, and always the year, because I can subtract from 2000.
Has there ever been an anniversary / April Fool's prank? Has that ever happened in your married life, or is that a little too on the nose?
There hasn't been. Although the day we got married, I did say to my father-in-law, "You know this is all a joke, right?" And he said, "It better not be, son." And it wasn't a joke. 25 years later, here we are on this beautiful day of April 1st, but also wherever you're listening, it's Jazz Appreciation Month.
Before we dive into that, happy silver anniversary. I think that's 25,
yeah,
right?
25.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
And yes, Jazz Appreciation Month is upon us. There's a lot to look forward to. And one of the things that I think some of us look forward to maybe most is the Jazz Bounty of Record Store Day.
Oh, yes.
Which falls this year on April 12th. If you are listening to The Late Set, I think you probably already know that Record Store Day has become a red letter day for archival jazz, especially stuff that has been dug out of the vault or sourced from some European broadcast archive.
Exactly.
And often very lovingly remastered, repackaged, and, you know, put out on labels like Resonance and Elemental and Reel to Reel, and, you know, also Kraft Recordings and Blue Notes getting into the game. So it's really become kind of the, I don't know, it's like the Super Bowl of old jazz made new.
Can you think, Nate, of a release, an archival release that has been as important as the Coltrane and Monk at Carnegie Hall?
That is a very good question, and I'm searching my brain right now. I'm tempted to say no, because, and before we say anything else, rest in peace, Larry Applebaum.
Yes,
absolutely. Brilliant archivist, scholar,
broadcaster
and journalist,
yep,
who for many years was at the Library of Congress, and he is the person who stumbled across that box of reel-to-reel
Voice
tapes.
Of America tapes.
And he's the one who put it on and immediately said, "Wait a minute, that's John Coltrane." So yeah, that album, which released, do you remember the year? Was it 2004, 5?
It's been a while. But there have been a number of new live concerts unearthed, mm-hmm, newly discovered, as you said, sort of plucked from the vaults of fill in the blank in
right,
terms of broadcasting organizations or presenters like festivals. And I can't really think of one that has been as impactful as that one was.
When you talk about historical importance, I think that album stands in a circle of its own.
Yeah.
But there have been some releases, you know, in this category that have meant a huge amount to me as a listener. And then there are others that are just, they're just great to return to. You know, we've talked on this podcast before about the McCoy Tyner Joe Henderson album that came out on Blue Note last year. I can't say that is as historically important, but I think it is significant.
It was worth hearing.
It's significant in the, I think that it permanently alters the conversation about the recorded body of work for Joe Henderson. Maybe not for McCoy, but I think it added a new chapter to the sort of public understanding of Joe Henderson as a tenor saxophone titan.
Right.
So that's significant, right? There's some Wes Montgomery that I think is pretty significant. There's some other Monk, you know, that's come out. And we should say, when we talk about Record Store Day as this, you know, major event day, really there's one person who is most responsible for that transformation, and that is Zev Feldman, who has been a producer with Resonance Records. He now works with Blue Note Records and many others. And he, if you've seen his name in, you know, in print, you've probably seen somebody add, maybe in quotes, the Indiana Jones of jazz.
Oh, yes. Or the jazz detective.
Right.
I get lost on all of these.
Yeah, there's lots of sobriquets.
Yes, nom de guerre.
But Zev really is, you know, I wrote a story for the New York Times back in 2016. At that point, people like us already knew his name, but he wasn't quite out there in the larger public. And at that time, when I wrote that piece, I interviewed Zev and we talked about, you know, his career. And I also talked to people like Michael Kuskuna, who had been a mentor to Zev. And Michael made a really good point, which was that, you know, there are lots of people who have the knowledge about the music, and there are lots of people who can sniff out this material. But there's something that Zev Feldman has that most other people do not have, and that is just absolute tenacity. He is a bulldog when it comes to chasing down the rights holders.
Oh, yes.
Making sure that everyone is okay with the contractual agreements. I mean, this is not glamorous work. The reason that I sort of chuckle at the Indiana Jones thing is because it's like, it's not the Indiana Jones who is swashbuckling with the fedora and the whip and, you know, punching Nazis in the face. It's the Indiana Jones who is like visiting that vault at the end of the movie with
boxes
aisles
everywhere.
And aisles of boxes.
Crates. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is painstaking, but at the center of it, for Zev and for listeners like us, it's passion.
You Absolutely.
Know? It's just like, this is exciting because these are, you know, these are uncovered moments in the timeline for many of these artists.
I have had an on again, off again relationship with some of these reissues, mm-hmm. if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
I got super annoyed last year because there were two Cannonball Adderley reissues that came out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I say reissue, but first time issues of what were, I believe, ORTF broadcasts, which is the national organization in France. One was Burning in Bordeaux, and the other, I think, was Pimping at the Pompidou or something. I think
Popping in Paris.
Popping in Paris. That's right. Popping in Paris. And I think that was the one, actually, that was the Black Messiah Band with George Duke.
Mm-hmm.
And I put that record on and I got so aggravated, Nate, because the first track, Black Messiah, and it was just tons of feedback coming off the stage that made it a very difficult experience for me as a listener. Now, I think maybe the idea is that my passion will allow me to get past
mm-hmm.
that stuff. But we have so much to listen to these days
right.
that, you know, does it all need to come out, I guess, is my question.
Well, you are describing a scenario that I think anyone can relate to, even if you aren't, you know, a record obsessive, which
yeah.
is bait and switch,
yeah.
you know, because you saw the lineup, you saw this incredible band that has not been as documented as we want it to be. And so you were like opening a gift on Christmas morning, you know, and the sound just ruined the whole thing. And it was, you know, it was like false advertising in a way, right? Because a lot of these releases actually sound quite good, especially when they're taken from European broadcasts, right?
Without a doubt. Well, since we're talking about all of these amazing discoveries and how they seem to come out on record store day releases, which, by the way, has become its own industry, Nate, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, we may have to reserve our judgment on a Bill Evans Trio release because it may not come necessarily for April 12th, but there's Black Friday, mm-hmm. record store day.
Right.
I mean, they've come up with lots of ways to continue to monetize the fact that fans are also collectors.
Right, right.
Which is the most important thing.
There is a practical real-world implication to all of this, which you probably know better than I do. The impact of this, you know, special event in the release calendar, you know, records have to be made somewhere. And there aren't that many places where they can be, you know, pressed, and that work has to happen in controlled environments. It has to happen, you know, with a certain amount of expertise. And if someone like Taylor Swift decides, well, this Record Store Day, I'm going to put out, you know, 9 different versions of this album in special, you know, limited variants.
It keeps the pressing plants busy on that.
It keeps them busy, but then, like, it, you know, can gum up the system, right? So is there an argument to be made that the eventizing of this release day on the calendar is actually kind of a problem for, you know, the year-round operations of these record plants?
I'm almost sure that reissue producers are factoring in all of that into their timeline. Mm-hmm. You know, Zev, for instance, the last time I saw him, it was just outside of Jazz at Lincoln Center, and he literally railed off, like, here are 15 releases that I'm currently working on, you know?
Yeah. And some of them were for, like, over a year in the future.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that that's part of the planning process. And, you know, so, but yes, there is a timeline from getting that source material, reviewing it, remastering it, and pressing it. Yeah, that's a mm-hmm. lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of steps.
Can you think of, so putting aside the issue of historical importance for a moment, can you think of a Record Store Day release over the last, you know, decade or so that you return to often, you know, that has a cherished place in your collection?
It's not a live performance, and it's not something mm-hmm. that I think comes from resonance or anything, but I have at least been appreciating the fact that Kraft has finally entered into the game in a significant way for some record collectors like me. I'll give you the one that I think is important, and that is Kenny Dorham's Quiet Kenny, which for Record Store Day came out in a limited mono issue, which they're doing another one this year with Jerry Mulligan and Monk, that record. So I say that because if you were to try to buy the original Kenny Dorham Quiet Kenny, you would probably be spending north of $4,000 for one record.
Oh, my God.
That's kind of where we are
yeah.
in those rare new jazz pressings, et cetera. So I like that some of these unobtainium recordings in their original pressing state mm-hmm. are now being made available with quality control and care and in mono, mm-hmm. which a lot of people who collect records care about the difference between mono and stereo.
Yeah. Maybe now is a good moment to mention the offerings from Kraft Recordings for Record Store Day 2025. We will also mention some of the other things coming out. Why don't we pause for a moment and hear a sliver of Mulligan Meets Monk. That is the Jerry Mulligan and Thelonious Monk album, Mulligan Meets Monk, which Kraft Recordings is releasing in a rare mono mix for Record Store Day. Yeah, I'm excited about that. I will seek that out. Kraft is also releasing Celia Cruz and Willie Colon's Only They Could Have Made This Album. Do you know this record?
I don't, but I believe that to be true.
It's a great title. Yeah. Also, the Vince Guaraldi Trio's Jazz Impressions of a Boy Named Charlie Brown.
Sure winner there.
And also Jazz Dispensary Nightlights, which features treasures from Prestige Records' Moodsville imprint, as well as Carla Thomas' album, Sweet Sweetheart, and a handful of other things. So that's Kraft Recordings. There is also at least one release from Blue Note Records, and I want to get your thoughts about this. This is titled Alts and Outs.
Oh, God.
And this is This is the RSD release. It's a edition of 2500 on LP, and it features outtakes and alternate tracks from a handful of Blue Note sessions. So, for instance, Bangoon from Cannonball Adderley's Something Else, an alternate take of Dance Cadaverous from Wayne Shorter's Speak No Evil, an alternate take of Monin from the Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers album. So this is literally, you know, the castaways all assembled on a new RSD platter. What do you think about that?
You know what I have to think about this, Nate? I'll be very honest with you. I think that if we're in an age of digital streaming where, you know, you can access this stuff and you're effectively just renting music, release it all. Put everything out, you know, keep mining the catalog, because I know that that is what effectively works for labels in terms of monetization. You know, notice the difference between them breaking new artists versus them constantly mining the catalog material. So in an age of digital streaming, why not? Just keep putting all this stuff out. But the crux is they also expect someone to purchase this and to have physical media for it. Then it becomes a different question to me. How many times am I going to pull this thing off the shelf? How important is it, a recording, for me to hear the alternate takes? I'll listen to that a couple of times. I know I will. And I'll just sort of, I'll internalize all those pieces of music, and then I'm going to move on. But I'm not going to be like, oh, let me pull out, what's it called? Alts and what?
Alts and outs.
Yeah, no. No, I'm not going to do it.
It does have the feeling of sort of, what are we going to do? What are we going to do this year? You know, like it feels a little obligatory. I mean, it obviously is opportunistic, right? It's like we're sitting on this catalog. Well, you know, here, we'll throw something together.
Yeah. Many years ago in the CD era, you know, Blue Note came up with something like the Lost Sessions, I think it was called, you know, where all of a sudden it was a compilation of things and there was a Thad Jones tune on there. I mean, it was a hip little compilation that Michael Cuscuna put together. And to me, he's always been the person related to Blue Note who has put the most interesting stuff out for the collector. And this goes back as far as the 70s when he was doing those double album compilations of catalog stuff from Blue Note that to me are the, if you collect LPs and you don't want to pay for original copies of some of those records, that's the way to go, is to get those budget line double LPs, some of which were pressed from the same masters.
Yeah. It's been an interesting evolution, right? To go from, you know, I mean, you and I own, I don't know how many Mosaic Records box sets, right? And this is a company that Michael Cuscuna co-founded and was involved with really until the end of his life.
Yeah.
And Mosaic has a really, you know, consistent and admirable commitment to scholarship, to, you know, archival integrity, and to audio fidelity. You know, it's just excellence all the way across. But it's also a sort of library model, you know? I think of like a shelf full of Mosaic Records boxes as akin to like a modern library edition in, you know, in somebody's library, right? And so that's great, and I love it. But it presumes a kind of connoisseurship.
An obsession,
right?
Yes.
It presumes that you want every false start and alternate take of the session in chronological order, basically, right?
Sounds like such a boy thing. I mean, it sounds like collecting baseball cards and stats.
You know, Frances Davis once quoted a woman who was I don't know if this was, you know, his partner or just a friend, but he quoted a female acquaintance who said that jazz was baseball by other means.
There it is. I can't imagine, you know, like a lot of people, even like my daughter, who loves this music, really kind of reaching for Lorde's discography to see, like, what all were on the sessions.
But so this is what I'm getting at. The core innovation or realization with these Record Store Day releases is it's kind of, you still have that feeling of connoisseurship a little bit because, like, here's something sort of rare interesting, and like it tells a story, you know. And so if you look at any Zev Feldman production for Resonance or anyone else, you will see lots of annotations, you'll see lots of photographs. So it's kind of the mosaic model, but it's adapted to a more consumer-oriented, more approachable, less fully geeked out version.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, I asked you about a treasured Record Store Day pick. We actually recently put on one of mine when we were hanging out. And this is, you know, it's just really, really nice. This is a recording of Joao Gilberto and Stan Getz playing the music from Getz Gilberto at Keystone Corner in, I think, 1977. And Astrid Gilberto is there, and Billy Hart is on drums. And I think Resonance only released this on vinyl. I don't think it's streaming anywhere, and I'm not sure that they even put it out on CD.
I don't think it's streaming. It may have been out on CD.
Okay. Yeah. But, you know, it's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
And to hear that music from, you know, from a truly iconic album played in a club setting very casually.
And also the amount of space that Getz gave Joao.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
To just do his thing.
I mean, sometimes I put it on and I just listen to Billy Hart's playing, you know, what he does on Brushes, playing these bossa novas, you know, behind a true master, you know. That's a lesson in and of itself. But it's a beautiful document. And so that's, you know, is it major? I don't know. I think it is. But the main thing is it just feels special. You know, it feels like it's a special document and it's beautifully produced. So that's kind of what this is about for me at its best.
It's okay for it to be extra, basically.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I would basically boil it down to one word. Mm-hmm. It's extra.
Yeah. Well, we have not yet mentioned, I think, two of the 2025 RSD releases that we are both most excited about. And I think that they are extra, extra.
They are certainly extra.
And this is fun because you'll see in a moment why these two go together. It's not just that they're both coming out on Resonance. But yeah, there's a real nice, well, there's a nice resonance between them.
Mm,
see what I did there?
Why don't we
segue with a little music? And at the risk of shocking everyone's, you know, limbic systems, let's drop the needle on a trumpet solo in the middle of the standard Bye Bye Blackbird.
That was Freddie Hubbard from the Blue Morocco in the Bronx, from a newly issued recording, Freddie Hubbard on Fire. What we just heard qualifies. Live from the Blue Morocco, Freddie Hubbard with Benny Maupin on tenor saxophone, pianist Kenny Barron, Herbie Lewis on bass, and drummer Freddie Waits, recorded in April of 1967.
That's right. April 10th, I believe.
Yeah.
And oh my God.
Oh my God. It's 24 minutes, this track, by the way.
This is track one of disc two. In the CD set. I assume it's probably side C in the LP set. But so I have a lot to say about this particular performance. But first, let's establish that we opened this episode of the late set with another trumpet-led quintet recorded at the Blue Morocco in 1967, and that was Kenny Dorham. And this was from an album titled Blue Bossa in the Bronx, live from the Blue Morocco, and it features Kenny Dorham with Sonny Red on alto saxophone, Cedar Walton on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Dennis Charles on drums.
Interesting combination of people.
Really interesting. And, you know, so Kenny Dorham is in a different point in his career in 1967 than Freddie Hubbard, obviously.
Yeah.
They are from two different generations. But it's fascinating because here we have two Record Store Day releases made in the same room in the same year, you know, possibly the same season. And they both feature this instrumentation of trumpet, saxophone, piano, bass, and drums. So it provides a really wonderful opportunity to think about this generational difference, this moment in time, this kind of transitional late 60s, you know, heading toward the early 70s period in jazz. So where do we begin?
I guess we should begin with a very bit of backstory for everyone. Mm-hmm. So this was a Monday night series that was started by a broadcaster. In fact, a broadcaster who started his career in Philadelphia, WDAS, a gentleman named Del Shields. Mm-hmm. At the time, he was working at WLIB in New York. And you know how Mondays are. That's, you know, kind of the off night for a lot of musicians. It's the reason why you can get things like the Vanguard Jazz Orchestra together and, you know, people aren't working, the union musicians aren't working in pits, et cetera.
Right.
So this was an opportunity for Del to try to get people to come to this place in the Bronx. And I can tell you, I looked up the address of the Blue Morocco, which is no longer in existence, and it is not the easiest place to get to, even if you're using public transportation.
Yeah.
So he did this Monday night series. If you can imagine, there were performances that were not recorded by Horace Silver, by Lee Morgan.
Wow.
But all of a sudden, these things started to get recorded, and now we have this amazing documentation of what that room sounded like. You know, that's one of the things for me is I love to listen to the sonic space of a room in the same way that we listen to the Vanguard and other places.
Well, we're going to talk about some of the technical and personal aspects of the recording, but first we should note...
Yeah.
The Blue Morocco has an interesting story in and of itself.
Totally. Sylvia Robinson.
So tell us about Sylvia.
Sylvia Robinson was a singer and a performer. Maybe you know her from, is it Sylvia and Mickey, I think?
Mickey and Sylvia.
Mickey and Sylvia.
Yeah. Yeah,
Love is Strange.
It was a hit in, I think, 1957.
Love is Strange, which is true. And so I guess maybe she parlayed some of that money and fame into having a space regularly in the Bronx for music. And this is it. She and her husband, Joe, ran the Blue Morocco. But it's sort of amazing to me when I think about that space. This is the same Sylvia Robinson. Maybe you can let people in on what she may be known for later in life.
Yes, she became the founder and CEO of Sugar Hill Records, the first hip-hop label. I mean, foundational figure. And so she's a really interesting person in American music history.
Running a club where jazz is every Monday night, and Del Shields, this broadcaster, is coming in, and somebody is coming in, some young kids is joining him to record this.
Yeah. And so this is where we get into the other sort of interesting character moment. Bernard Drayton.
Mm.
He is the recording engineer for both of these albums and presumably a whole bunch of other recordings. And Bernard Drayton, well, do you know his story? Do you know much about him?
I don't know a whole lot other than I have heard things that he's done before because he recorded the Milford Graves and Don Pullen collaboration at Yale.
And I think he also recorded the Olatunji concert, which is, I think, the very last John Coltrane recording. So he's somebody who was... He was certainly circulating and with his portable reel-to-reel equipment and microphones, like he was documenting. I'm not sure whether he had posterity in mind as he was doing that, you know?
These were live broadcasts.
Oh, okay. All right.
These were Monday night live broadcasts on the radio.
That wasn't true of the Pullen and Milford, though,
no,
was it?
Okay. No. But for the Blue Morocco... These were, Del Shields was on LIB for like 5 hours stretch at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was just baked into his Monday night show.
All right. Also, fun fact, Bernard Drayton, I think, was the father of Charlie Drayton, who has been a stalwart drummer in Bob Dylan's touring band. I've seen him with Dylan, so had no idea that his father was involved in recording jazz. I, you know, probably should have known that, but that's a really cool, and Charlie is actually a co-producer of this release, or these releases.
Yeah, it's pretty exceptional that these things have made it to light. And I have to tell you, I hope there are more of them, because if they're anything like these two, Nate, they're worth listening to. Both the Kenny Dorham and the Freddie Hubbard recordings are great. There's one joke, though. I remember when we were trading these back and forth to each other, and I gave you the Kenny Dorham, and you said, well, I think I'm missing a second disc.
Right.
And I said, well, that's, I think it's just because you're used to it being so much of everything.
Yeah.
And this is just one disc, one very crowded disc
CD. Well, let's talk about the Kenny session.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about Freddie. So this Kenny Dorham recording, it's really interesting because he is, you know, he's kind of on the tail end of his career, but still playing very, very well. And he's playing bebop, you know?
Like confirmation. Charlie Parker's confirmation.
This is a bebop session at a time when that mode, idiom, language was, you know, generally understood to be in the rear view, you know, in terms of cultural currency. I mean, bebop is a forever language. It is, as the late Barry Harris would say, it is, you know, it is still very much a currency. But, you know, there was so much in the culture and in the discourse around jazz in the 60s, and especially the mid to late 60s, that was kind of about hurtling forward, you know, and like new freedoms, new license, new ways of doing things. And so it's interesting to think about the torch bearing of this session, you know, and all the musicians on that bandstand, Paul Chambers, Cedar Walton, you know, young players, well, not in the case of PC, but Cedar was
fairly young at that time.
Yeah. But just the idea that this is, you know, bebop is a music of the 1940s, and here we are in 67, and it's still crackling.
It still feels good,
yeah.
Especially when one of the persons who was a part of that language, Kenny Dorham, is playing it. I mean, he was on sessions with Charlie Parker, you know? I mean,
he was on 52nd Street.
He had internalized all that music, and so it wasn't especially new for him, but he was really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel that way about Kenny Dorham. It's not the high level acrobatics, trumpet work, you know. He has a very sort of internalized, almost pinched sound that feels like someone who's an introvert, really. And so, but he always, his ability to use turnarounds and his harmonic language is beautiful.
He's very, very lyrical as well.
Very.
Yeah.
Very. So, to me, it's just a nice thing to be able to hear Kenny Dorham. This is 5 years before he perishes from essentially kidney failure, you know, and his health would diminish soon after this. So, it's great to still hear him in form, playing well, and playing, like I said, Charlie Parker's Confirmation, and hearing Paul Chambers do a bowed solo during was lovely.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot in here that just, it sounds good. And I think to myself, what would be the application for me as a listener for music like this?
Okay.
And it really is, I have to find myself at a moment in my basement where I just want to put something on and imagine that I'm in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what does it these two recordings do it for me, because I've never been in the Blue Morocco. I knew a little bit about it, but it allows me to sort of feel that ambiance and also to hear what the musicians were doing at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a beautiful recording.
It is, and I'm looking forward to spending some more time with it. I will confess, however, that it has been eclipsed somewhat by the absolute explosive excitement of this Freddie Hubbard recording, On Fire, which is aptly titled. We've already mentioned, I think, that he was leading a band with Benny Maupin on tenor, and Kenny Barron on piano, Herbie Lewis on bass, Freddie Waits on drums. And what they all do as a unit is spectacular. But the most spectacular thing, let's be honest, is what Freddie is doing on the horn. I don't know that there is a document that makes a better case for him as just a genius on that instrument. He is in such rare form, and he's just going for it, you know? We talked about this a bit, but that Bye Bye Blackbird is so fascinating to me, because this is a song that I think, you know, we all associate with the Miles Davis Quintet.
Mm-hmm.
And you really get the sense from this, you know, remember, it's April of 1967. That Miles band, everybody was listening to them, you know? And Freddie certainly had spent time, I'm sure he had, you know, caught them at the Vanguard. He'd probably seen them, you know, on some European tour where they crossed paths. He was paying attention. And what you hear the band do on this performance of that tune feels like a sort of a tip of the cap, maybe a little competitive, you know, maybe a little bit like, I see what you're doing over there, and here's my version of it. It's so streamlined and on the edge and aggressive and slashing and just brilliant, you know?
I feel like Freddie Waits
mm-hmm.
had a hand in that too.
Yeah.
On this date, because what he and Freddie are doing together, I think, was really, really forceful. I mean, this is an interesting part of Freddie's career. So mm-hmm. he's no longer with Blue Note Records. He's made a ton of great records for them. And this is the year, I believe, that Backlash came out, which was an early recording that he had for Atlantic. So mm-hmm. he's in his period where he's recording for Atlantic.
Yeah. And since we're here talking about labels and such, you know, the reason that Freddie is not on Blue Note anymore, like Joe Henderson and a number of other people, is in 1966, I think.
Yes.
Blue Note was sold to Liberty. And so the Alfred Lion era has come to an end, right?
It's over. It's over. And a lot about what we recognize as greatness with Blue Note sort of ends there. But there are still a ton of amazing records that still came out during mm-hmm. the Liberty era. You know, for instance, they stopped pressing all their records at Place Delight in New Jersey, mm-hmm. and they moved everything to Aldisc because that's what Liberty owned. So even the pressings changed, you know, which sometimes has an effect on
I'm sure.
how people hear
yeah.
certain things. You know, I think the Jody Grind, Horace Silver's record, the Jody Grind, was the last record that came out before Liberty started. But yeah, there's tons of great Liberty records. But yeah, it's all those people mm-hmm. were no longer recording music for Blue Note anymore.
Yeah. You know, we mentioned the Joe Henderson McCoy Tyner album, Forces of Nature. That's another one that was made, you know, it was a club gig at Slugs just at that moment when Joe Henderson is no longer a Blue Note artist, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's interesting, this moment, this sort of pivot point, right?
And Time for Tyner is a Liberty
yeah.
recording.
So the set list on this Freddie Hubbard set, which, you know, it's probably two sets of music. It's two CDs, and I imagine it's four LPs. I need to check. But it includes an interesting mix of his Blue Note repertoire and then this kind of burgeoning new repertoire on Atlantic. So he plays Crisis, he plays Breaking Point, and then he also plays this tune, Echoes of Blue, which I struggled to place it, and you...
Yeah, it's from Backlash.
You let me know that it was on Backlash. So yeah. Why don't we hear a bit of that tune?
That's Echoes of Blue, a composition of Bob Cunningham's, who was on the original date, Backlash, with Freddie Hubbard. This is from Live at the Blue Morocco. Freddie Hubbard on fire. En fuego.
En fuego. I think it's funny. I didn't even have that title in mind when I texted you. When I first put this on, I said, Freddie Waits on this album is on fuego.
Yes, exactly. He really is.
And, you know, let's take a moment. You gave him a little dap a moment ago, but Freddie Waits, a really incredible drummer, also father of our friend Nasheed Waits.
Yes.
But Freddie is, it's interesting to hear him in this band because, you know, there's this thing that he does that actually Nasheed does as well and has sort of carried forward. An expression of this tumbling polyrhythmic idea that is related to but distinct from what Elvin does. You know, Elvin Jones has a certain polyrhythmic signature, and Freddie has obviously internalized that, but he's got his own slant on all of that. And similarly, there's a kind of cymbal beat that Tony Williams has that's really influential, and I think Freddie has studied that as well. But again, he has his own signature, you know, and Max Roach means a certain thing to him. And so he's synthesized a lot of the older percussive language, but he's also like really tuned into what is unfolding at that moment. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he'd also been listening to Jack DeJohnette, who was just coming up, you know.
Sure.
But yeah, his playing throughout this set is just really, really special.
Yeah, it's nice to hear both of them, Freddie and Freddie, mm-hmm. as it were.
Ready for Freddy's.
Ready for Freddy's. Yeah, maybe that's what we should call it. Yeah, I don't have much more to say other than just, yeah, you need a good drummer to make a good horn player sound the way Freddie Hubbard sounded, and Freddie Waits helped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
as we talk about the kind of the missing piece or what have you that can sometimes, you know, sometimes we get that from a live recording that is unexpected, right? This band was actually documented on a previous archival release, which was titled Fastball. Live at the Left Bank. And so I'll pose it to you as a question. I mean, does this Blue Morocco recording add something really important to our understanding of Freddie's career, or is it kind of just another really burning recording?
That's a great question, Nate. I don't know that this is anything more than just another great Freddie Hubbard night,
mm-hmm.
but it's an especially good one.
What a night. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, if you had to compare those two, Fastball and this new Live at the Blue Morocco performance, not only the performance, but the recording is much better.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, first of all, you couldn't even hear the damn piano at the Left Bank Society. At least you're hearing Kenny Barron play a Baldwin Acrosonic in moderate shape, but you can hear him.
Yeah. And you can, and it sounds like Kenny.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a really good Kenny Barron performance. Yeah, the sound quality for me is key.
It is.
I honestly haven't spent that much time with that Fastball release. I think partly because it was just sort of a bummer to, like, as a sonic experience.
That's what I mean. You know, it's the same feeling that sort of engendered when I listened to that Cannonball Adderley, mm-hmm. with all the stage feedback.
Right.
You know, after a while, you just like, I don't want to work that hard as a mm-hmm. listener.
Right. So that's what is special, I think, about this release. It's very listenable. I think it's a very solid, you know, live recording. And, you know, as I said to you before, there are moments on this set that I think are basically as impressive as anything that has happened on a trumpet in a jazz setting. And you know, I mean, just like it really does not get more astonishing than some of what Freddie puts down here.
It's also very nice to hear Benny Maupin.
Yes. How have we not?
I can't believe we haven't talked about him. Yeah. I will say that having listened to him on this record, it did strike me sometimes some of the things that both he and Joe Henderson, mm-hmm. like a very similarity of sounds occasionally.
Yeah.
I mean, they're their own people. We know this. But clearly, you know, Benny seriously contributed on this stage.
Yeah, he's a terrific frontline partner and an incredible soloist, which reminds me, that is another thing that I really appreciated about the Kenny Dorham record is Sonny Red.
I think he stole the show.
Sonny Red sounds really, really good.
I think he was the best part of that.
And as we talk about that bebop language, you know, Sonny makes it feel thrilling. You know, he makes it feel like it is still being discovered, which is so key. You know, we've both sat through, you know, some very well played bebop sets that felt just like, you know, like you're reading the dictionary. You know,
congratulations, you got the bebop medal.
Right. But yeah, it's exciting. You know, when you hear someone who is attacking it with that sense of like a new frontier.
And to be able to hear him at all, really, I mean, you know, he did some sessions with Donald Byrd as mm-hmm. well. It's nice to hear. He had that real sort of dry, acerbic sound, mm-hmm. very similar to a Jackie McLean, you know. So I like to hear more of him, but he's really great on this.
Yeah. Well, I think that wraps up our
nerding out
side-by-side comparison of two great trumpet-led quintets at the Blue Morocco in 1967. Let it never be said that the late set fails to serve our
go down the rabbit
record,
hole.
Record nerd constituency.
Yeah.
This one's for you. I also want to note that Resonance has another Record Store Day release dropping. This is a Charles Mingus late 70s session titled In Argentina, the Buenos Aires Concerts. It's a 3 LP or 2 CD set. So that's another one to look out for. I regret that we are not spending time on that, but we had a lot of trumpet to talk today.
Yeah, talk trumpet.
There are other Record Store Day releases. You can find out more at recordstoreday.com. You can also, you know, just follow us on socials. I'm sure we'll be talking about some other releases. But yeah, I think it's safe to say that this Freddie record is my top pick this year.
It is. And it was nice to hear KD as well.
Yes, it was. Now is the time in this program when we start digging. This I dig.
Of you.
So as if this episode has not been
nerdy enough.
Jazz nerdy enough. here comes some even deeper nerddom from the jazz archival files.
Oh boy.
What do you think of when I say the name Frankie Newton?
Frankie Newton?
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Oh, I love it. How often do we see Josh Jackson on the back foot when it comes to obscure jazz figures? Frankie Newton was a trumpet player.
Yes,
yeah.
I mean, I know. I thought that much.
He played on the original recording of Strange Fruit, did a number of other things. But the reason I know Frankie Newton is that he was a mentor to my mentor, George Wein. George was friendly with the woman who Frankie fell in love with. And as a very young man, George got to know Frankie and, you know, followed him around and played with him a little bit. And Frankie had a very interesting story because he was an outspoken advocate for social justice. And he was a member of the American Communist Party. He has this very murky place in jazz history. Not a lot is known about him. But he was a beautiful, beautiful player who especially had a gift for this kind of soft lyricism with a mute, you know?
Yeah.
So he's kind of a precursor to the Miles Davis that we know and love. Anyway, there is a brilliant piece of writing in the New York Review of Books that came out in late March. And this is by Matthew Rivera, who is a scholar currently working with the Louis Armstrong House Museum. Matthew Rivera has spent the last decade obsessed with Frankie Newton. And he has chased down every lead and, you know, gone hunting through archives and thrift sales. And he found a whole bunch of writing that Frankie did for various communist publications. And it sheds new light on his life and his way of thinking. And so this piece is titled Frankie Newton, Lost and Found. It is a beautiful piece of writing and I think an important piece of jazz scholarship. So I highly recommend it.
They missed a key opportunity to call this the Red Letter Diaries.
They did.
I bet you a lot more people would have bought it than the jazz nerds who are like, give me some of this, Frankie.
Well, it's funny, lost and found. That word lost has become so, it's become like a kind of currency in jazz history. You know, it's, oh, here's a lost session, a lost album.
Yeah.
Here's a whole lost person. So...
Webster Young. That'll be the next one. Let's talk about Webster Young, folks.
All right. I'm interested in Serge Shaloff.
Serge Shaloff.
Yeah.
Whose mother was Chicoria's piano
That's
teacher.
That's right. Madame Shaloff was also George Wein's piano teacher.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's that Boston.
Boston.
Yeah. Frankie Newton. So what have you got, Josh?
I'm going to tell you about public radio because that's so exciting.
It's kind of an edge of the seat topic these days, actually.
It is, yes, exactly.
Unfortunately.
You know, speaking of communists, let's talk about public media.
There you have it. Yeah. We'll be here all week.
Yes, exactly.
We'll be here all week.
Yeah, I know. We'll see. It depends on which chair of the subcommittee related to whatever. Anyway, there's something that I heard that was public media created, and that was a conversation on Fresh Air with Terry Gross and Bill Burr.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I heard it, I chatted some of you. You were included in this.
Yeah.
And I said, you got to listen to this just because it's great radio.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned something that I think I'm just going to say, and that was there's disagreement happening on public radio between these two people, two titans, really, you mm-hmm. know, like Bill Burr, who's, you know, very, very strident in some ways, you know, and has a very defined personality and persona as well as Terry Gross. And so it's like hot meets cool, mm-hmm. man, and like this front is created, and it was a little stormy.
Yeah.
At times. And it was a little tense. And it felt good. It really felt good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I'm going to say this. I feel like the logic stream of Bill Burr wasn't necessarily it was a little bit on some quicksand there at times. And he always gave himself the out, you know, saying, well, you know, I'm just a mess. I'm just, my whole life is a mess.
Right.
And it was like an easy exit sometimes mm-hmm. from sort of confronting what Terry wanted to have, which was a very serious conversation about, you know, how women perceive Bill Burr's act.
Right.
But then it got tense occasionally because at one point she used the word bros in her question and it set him off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. I mean, it's just an interesting dynamic between those two. I think ultimately it was professional and courteous, but it also had a little bit more fire than I'm accustomed to on public radio, which I say more of that,
mm-hmm.
more actual personality
and
less sounding nice all the time.
Right. It was interesting to hear because Bill Burr is kind of the embodiment of the happy warrior, you know?
Yeah.
Like he's ready to stir it up. And there's a baseline of sort of cordial exchange on Fresh Air. And there are a few moments where she was trying to either voice a question and he was interrupting and resetting. And she was like, well, let's bring it back to this, you know, like she was getting kind of flustered.
It's hard to control.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you call that good radio. And I agree. but it's not polished, right? It's like the tension is what makes it good radio. You know, things are being like, there's a tug of war at times.
And there's a mystery. You really don't know.
Where is this going?
Where is this thing going to go?
Yeah.
And to me, that's a reason for people to listen. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing that they said always about Howard Stern.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's going to say next. That's why I listen.
Right.
Because I just don't know what's coming next. Yep. And I didn't know what was coming next from that interview with Terry Gross and Bill Burr. But I knew that it was entertaining me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I co-sign that endorsement. Thanks to you for putting it on my radar. So now we're sharing it with y'all. Yeah. Wow. Lots to listen to.
Always.
You know what to do, folks. Get out there. Listen to some music. Listen to some talking about music. Listen to some talking about other things.
Keep your ears finely tuned.
There you have it. Happy Jazz Appreciation Month. Happy Record Store Day. If you have any thoughts about Record Store Day or anything else we've talked about, hit us up. You can reach us at editor@wrti.org. That email goes to me. We'd be happy to hear from you. Also, please rate the show. If you like The Late Set, don't be quiet about it.
Yeah, this episode I know is going to bring the yard. 5 stars. These guys really went crazy on the deep nerddom.
Right. We gotta be us.
Alex is like, let me get out of here. I'm done with you too. The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Thank you, members. It's hosted by me, Josh Jackson, with Nate Chenin.
The show is produced by Alex Arif.
WRTI's operation manager is Joe Patti, and assistant director of production is Tyler McClure. Associate general manager for content and programming is me, and Bill Johnson is WRTI's general manager.
If you are liking this show, why don't you give us a 5-star rating wherever you are listening? Let us know how we're doing. You can also stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we're cooking up here in Philadelphia and beyond. We'll see you soon.